Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Our podcast today is brought to you by 8 Sleep. And hey, a quick reminder, I'm just take a moment to try to sell you some stuff, including our newsletters. We have 3 newsletters at the Bulwark. I have the Morning Shots newsletter. Jonathan Last has a midday newsletter, and Jim Swift has a newsletter with links to all of our highlights later in the day. I strongly recommend that if you want to get more of the Bulwark right into your email box, you can subscribe, as well as you can subscribe to this podcast. Look, a couple of things we're going to keep our eye on. I mean, this is the day after the stock market meltdown. There's lots of speculation about whether that means we're going to have a recession before the election. And unfortunately, the autopsy of Jeffrey Epstein is going to create, we use the term tsunami too much, but a tsunami of conspiracy theories. I mean, this is going to go on forever. Also, more decidedly mixed signals from the Trump administration about Hong Kong and China. We had the report yesterday that Trump had promised President Xi that he would not condemn the Chinese government over the crackdown in Hong Kong because it was an internal issue, and we were just going to stay out of that. And then there is this really troubling new Fox poll, troubling if you're a Trumpkin, leaving aside the approval, non-approval numbers, which are pretty much same old, same old. There are some interesting, if you get into some of the internals here, nearly 6 in 10, and again, this is a Fox News poll, nearly 6 in 10 respondents said they think that Trump is tearing the country apart rather than drawing it together. And you focus in on suburban women, and it is a huge majority of suburban women who are now saying the President of the United States is tearing the country apart rather than pulling it together. But I wanted to do a couple of things today, including a deep dive into one of the most important stories I think that we've ever published at the Bulwark. We have 2 guests, by the way, today. Ben Parker from the Bulwark staff. Good to have
you
back, Ben.
Hey, Charlie, how are you?
And Kathy Young, who is making her initial, you're like a freshman now, on the Bulwark podcast. And Kathy wrote this extraordinary story about pushing back against the moral outrage campaigns. Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast, Kathy.
Thank you. It's really great to be here.
To introduce you to our listeners, I'm looking at your Twitter ID. Okay, so it's Russian Jewish American, pro freedom, reason, nuance, civility, and in brackets, exceptions may apply. And and you are also pro otters.
Yes.
Okay.
They're part of my Twitter persona.
and if you're wondering, this is the Kathy Young who writes for Reason, for Arc Digital, who is a columnist for Newsday, who appears in Bulwark. You are a prolific writer, but I want to talk to you about
Ben. I just wanted to add that I'm a huge, huge fan of the Bulwark. I think it's great that it exists.
Well, and it is great that you offered this latest piece about Yale, because I know you spent a great deal of time. It is an extraordinary deep dive into a story that I think some people might be familiar with. The piece is it's on the site, Standing Up to the Moral Outrage Machine. Moral Outrage Industry. What we can learn from how Yale handled a woman named Sarah Brosh and the Napping While Black incident. I don't expect anybody recognizes Sarah Brosh's name, but I think they might recognize that the Napping While Black story. And as you point out, coming less than a month after 2 black men were arrested at a Philadelphia Starbucks while waiting for someone without making a purchase, the Yale dorm incident quickly became the new symbol of everyday racism. A caller, this is Sarah Brosh, briefly, you've seen in a video clip, says, "I have every right to call the police. You cannot sleep here," was easily cast as the embodiment of smug white privilege. When this woman, Sarah Brosh, was identified the next day, a Twitter chorus sprang up to denounce her as a freakish bigot and an overeducated racist. Your piece says, yeah, but there's another side to this story. And so let's walk through this a little bit, Kathy. First of all, why did you become interested in this story? Because it was one of those Twitter conflagrations that I think most people probably thought had died down and people had forgotten about.
Right. Right. Well, the Twitter conflagration certainly died down. But I'll tell you, I was kind of curious about that story from the beginning. And the way that it was officially presented was that this woman who is a graduate student at Yale called the police simply because she saw a Black woman who was also a grad student sleeping in a lounge on her floor. And that just felt to me like one of those stories where, like, wait, there's got to be something else there, you know, because, you know, the interpretation that people kind of ran with was that, well, you know, this woman is so incapable of seeing a Black woman as a peer and a fellow grad student that she saw this woman sleeping in a lounge and she just automatically assumed that she was an intruder.
Well, yeah, no, I mean, it was very easy to put this into the narrative. It fit into that existing narrative, and she certainly did look like the garden variety bigot.
The thing that kind of gave me pause is that, you know, surely, you know, living on the Yale campus, this woman must run sometimes into, and probably a lot of time, into other Black students. So it just seemed a little bizarre to me that, you know, simply running into a Black classmate who was sleeping in this lounge would, you know, somehow make her decide that this was an intruder and call the police. So I was kind of curious from the beginning about, you know, what is actually going on there. And then what happened was that eventually Sarah Brosh, who is kind of in exile from the Yale campus, and I'll get to that in a bit, but, you know, she's living in an undisclosed location. She's, you know, she's gotten a million death threats, and she's just really been in a very, very bad situation. She eventually joined Twitter. She also started posting some videos where she kind of tries to tell her side of the story. I heard from some people who've been in touch with her and who are sort of sympathetic and believe that she got a bum rap. And eventually I did sort of get interested in telling that side of the story. I had a couple of phone conversations with Sarah, and she said that she was willing to send me like a large trove of material, mainly her correspondence with various Yale officials, which she said would sort of tell the side of the story that didn't get told. And eventually that is how I ended up writing this.
And one of the things that's interesting is that you don't necessarily buy everything that she says. You don't agree with all of her interpretations. And so you do look at the nuance, but there are a couple of real red flags here for objective outsiders, including the fact that you notice, you know, very high up in your story that the disciplinary charges of race-based harassment that were filed against Sarah Brosh by the Yale Graduate School of Arts and Sciences back in June of 2018 were in fact formally withdrawn in October. And while those charges were pending, 9 Yale professors wrote these glowing character letters on her behalf, most of them stressing her passionate anti-racism. And knowing the environment, you know, it is not a risk-free thing for a Yale professor to intervene in a case that had gone this radioactive.
Right. Well, you know, I will say that those letters were written to the dean. They were not publicly released letters.
Right,
so,
still.
And of those 9 professors, there were only 2 who were actually willing to speak publicly, although I should add that one of them basically said that he would have been willing to speak, but he felt that it would sort of be almost a conflict of interest because he not only wrote that letter, but he also kind of represented Sarah Brosh as her advisor in her dealings with the Yale administration.
Okay.
So he just felt that he was sort of too close to the case and that it would not. But yeah, there were a lot of people who were willing to write these private commendations, but were
I'm glad you corrected
publicly,
me. Though,
which is understandable.
Yeah, this is not a profiles and courage necessarily, but to get to the bottom line here, you go through all of this, and I strongly urge people to read the whole story because it really does reflect, you know, how varied and human this story is. you know, that basically say that it's extremely unlikely that Sarah Brash's motivation for calling the police was racist. Rather, you write, the brief confrontation was a perfect storm of bad circumstances, escalating personal conflicts, Brash's difficult history both before and after coming to Yale, and her troubled emotional state, and the climate of racial tension and hyper-awareness in which every conflict across racial lines could be a spark falling on a powder keg. So this is like a novel. This story of all of this.
I really felt when I was researching this, I felt like, you know, this guy, I'm writing a, you know, Dostoevsky novel or something like that.
So what is, you know, to the extent you can summarize it, because don't right. deal with the whole thing. What is Brash's personal history? What led up to that moment where she sees someone sleeping and calls the cops?
Well, you know, I'll tell you, this ended up being a really long story, and not to scare people away, but it is quite a lengthy piece. Although, you know, people tell me that it reads very, very easily and quickly. But I just felt that there is no way to tell a story without kind of going into the full history of Sarah Brash. And one reason is, and several of the people who wrote those letters in support of her noted, that she does have kind of hyper, sensitive issues around her personal safety. And one reason for that is that she grew up in this extremely toxic environment where she had apparently an abusive father, this family who was just very, very dysfunctional. There was also a kind of religious aspect where her parents apparently had this very strong belief in demons who were basically like anything you could do could result in demonic possession. You could really sort of get attacked by demons at the time. And she moved away from that when she was a teenager. She basically broke off all relations with her family when at 16. She moved away to college as an independent student. Is actually academically was incredibly successful. She got 2 degrees from the University of Minnesota, where she's from, in aerospace engineering, and I forget there's another kind of engineering degree. And I do sort of go into this quite candidly, you know, she had a lot of mental health issues starting with when she was a teenager, partly because of her background. She also had a couple of sexual abuse episodes. She had a kind of mental health breakdown when she was in grad school for the first time at the University of Berkeley. She ended up dropping out and, you know, doing a lot of other things. At the age of 30, she says she kind of had an epiphany where she decided that she wanted to kind of work on human rights issues and to get a law degree, which she did from Fordham University. And by the way, this is why people are calling her an overeducated bigot, because there were a lot of reports saying, oh, by the way, this woman has 5 different degrees, which, you know, which she does. But, you know, that's really, you know, neither here nor there, other than to show that, you know, she really is a very, very talented person who's done all these different things. She went to Fordham University to the law school. And by the way, she also got, in addition to the letters that she got from people at Yale, she also had one from one of her professors at Fordham. She spent some time in France, I think about a year, with a group of French feminists, a lot of whom were actually Black women with an African background, a lot of whom were Arab women, who were working on issues of essentially sexism affecting immigrant women.
Okay, so you're painting a picture of an incredibly bright, hardworking, right, but deeply troubled woman whose politics were, if anything, quite progressive.
Oh, right. And this was, by the way, one of the things that, again, got stressed by the professors who wrote on her behalf, just in terms of her, personal turmoil,
Okay.
I think it is important to add
Sure.
that she
Okay.
also.
So let's fast forward now to this dorm, to the interactions in this dorm,
Right.
because
So the
and because
introduction of the dorm.
you do describe the atmosphere and her concerns about who was in the dorm and what was going on that really didn't have anything to do with race.
No. And I do point out that she previously had, by the way, an episode about a year before this where she called, she also contacted the police, and she contacted Yale Housing with concerns about possibly being stalked by a white facilities worker who was working on that floor. And I do think that looking at that incident, actually, I think it does seem to me that she was being a little too hyper vigilant. I don't think there was any real evidence that this person that she
But this
that
was a
she was
pre-existing
on
condition. She was
the but yeah
concerned
but
about her
race is not an
safety.
issue in this. I mean,
Sure.
race is really not an issue in this. And this episode, the episode specifically with the call to the police over the sleeping woman, this actually began in February. So this happened in May. The real beginning of the saga was in February of last year, when Sarah Brash had an encounter in the elevator of the dorm with a guy named Renaissance Jean-Louis, who is also a black student in the master's program at Yale, who's a friend of the woman that eventually was at the center of this other incident. And what happened was that Sarah Brash gets into the elevator in her dorm. She was living, by the way, by herself on the 12th floor. And this is kind of an important part of the story. She gets in the elevator. This guy gets in the elevator with her and waits for her to activate the elevator with her card key, because obviously, the dorm has one of these elevators that you need a room key to activate. She realizes that he doesn't have a key, so he's not a resident. He ends up going to the same floor that she's going to. And then when she gets off the elevator, he also gets off the elevator, and then he just kind of stands there. Now, the reason he was standing there, as it turns out, was entirely legitimate, because he had been invited to a party in the lounge that was also on that floor, and he didn't see anybody there. People hadn't, showed up yet. So he's standing there trying to figure out if he's in the right location. And from Sarah Brash's point of view, she is on this otherwise deserted floor, near the door to her room, with this guy who is not a resident of the dorm and is really just kind of standing behind her. So, and I don't think you even really need to be especially paranoid to, to get a little alarmed over this, no matter what the race of the person, because, I think a lot of women would probably feel a little kind of freaked out in that situation. So, she decides to kind of, just to be on the safe side, to walk one floor down and then come up different flight of stairs. And when she does, she does, the guy is no longer there on the floor. And she thinks that he's left, and then suddenly he calls out to her from the stairwell, saying, "Is this where the lounge is, where the common room is?" And this is when she gets really, really nervous, and she actually tells him that he's making her very nervous, which, obviously he interprets in a, in a racial light, as, a white woman having a nervous reaction to a black guy. And they have a kind of verbal exchange. She says, "You're not supposed to be in the building if you're not a resident, and you really should leave." And then she goes inside a room, and she says, just to be on the safe side, she decides to call the cops. And by the way, the thing that also is kind of important to realize is that this is not the equivalent of calling 911, where cops are going to show up with guns blazing. This is a non-emergency campus police line, where really they're just going to come over and see, you know, what is going on and whether there is any kind of a problem. So she calls and they say, and she even says apparently that, you know, I don't know if you really need to come out here, but, you know, I just wanted to let you know that this guy is here who doesn't seem to be a resident of the building. And by the way, you know, the rule at Yale, as I think at most colleges, is that you really cannot be in a dorm unaccompanied unless you're a resident of that dorm.
Sure.
Like if you're a student, but you're from some other dorm, you're not supposed to hang out there. So by that time, the other people at the party, including Lola de Cianvala, who is the woman who was later involved in this incident.
Okay. How do you pronounce that name again? How is it?
I believe it's Lola de Cianvala.
Okay. Okay. So this is a name we're going to be hearing again. This is the woman who later becomes the quote unquote victim of the napping while black story, right?
Right, okay. Right. Okay, right. So Cianvala was apparently the person who was actually hosting this party, and she was a resident of the same dorm, living on the fifth floor. Which, by the way, didn't. And some people have asked me, by the way, well, why was Cianvala in this room on the 12th floor, this common room on the 12th floor in the first place? Why wasn't she in the one on her floor? Well, that dorm actually had only two common rooms. One was in the basement, and one was on the 12th floor. So there actually was an entirely legitimate reason that she was.
So four police officers.
Right. So four police officers arrive, and they basically say, "Oh, you know, we've had a call about a suspicious character." And I don't think, by the way, that Sarah Brosh ever used that specific phrase. As far as I know, she really just said, "You know, there's a man here who is not a resident of the of the dorm, and you know, I think you should check it out." So they come, you know, looking for a suspicious character, and Lola de Cianvala tells them that this is a guest of hers, and he shows his Yale ID, and then they're like, okay, you know, we've checked it out, where we're going. But of course, to the people at the party, and I believe this was a party that was all African-American students, this really was a kind of insult, where they, from their point of view, they can't get together for a party without getting hassled by the police. And, you know, and I will say, by the way, reading about the situation at Yale, reading some of the accounts by Black students at Yale, I mean, I think that there is a real problem of racial profiling. I think this is a very real situation where basically, you know, there's a fairly small percentage of the student body that is African-American. I think it's about 7% at this point. They live in a town where a third of the population is Black. There's a fairly high crime rate, and I hadn't realized that, by the way, but New Haven actually does have a crime rate that is, you know, much higher than the rest of Connecticut or the United States. And, you know, there have been cases in which people who were African-American, you know, were either intruders or, committed some sort of, you know, sorts of crimes on the campus. And there is a tendency for the police, like and for residents sometimes, to think that someone who's Black is, you know, is not a student, but somebody who's come in from New Haven.
So I want to move the story ahead here, because the fact that they sent four cops reflects that concern, right? I mean, four seems like a lot for one guy.
I think it's quite possible that they may have thought, and you know, I didn't actually get to mention this in the story just because I had so much other material, but actually in April of that year, there was a robbery in a dorm that was committed by somebody from New Haven, who had come in from the outside. So there was a real concern about, you know, intruders in the dorms. That was not an entirely frivolous issue. What happened after that,
let me just walk through it a little bit, because I know this is a very detailed story, and I don't want to get lost in the weeds too much here, because what's very clear from your story is this one incident then sets off a chain reaction of charges and countercharges, and she says that they were harassing her. Sarah Roche says they were standing outside her door, and calling her names.
Left, there, a couple and, of people.
Right. Okay. And the two key players in all of this, the two African American students, the one that she had called the police on and the one she would later call the police on,
right,
sent
they
a, wrote
complaint.
Right, they wrote a complaint. So this all happened
before so
the napping.
This is all happening. Like the key events happen in the couple of months before the napping while black incident, where what happens is that Sarah Brush initially is reassured by the housing managers in the dorm that she didn't do anything wrong. You know, she had every right to call the police. And in fact, she should call the police if she thinks that there's something suspicious going on. So, you know, as far as she's concerned, this whole thing is over. And in the meantime, suddenly, a few days later, she is called in for a meeting with the housing director, who says, you know, I just wanted to let you know that there is this complaint accusing you of racism. And this complaint was submitted to the dean for diversity, and there's a long title that I can't remember.
So what month are we in here? This is
March. This is early March.
So the napping incident doesn't happen until May. I want people to understand that this was already, you know, in fuego.
So yeah, this is underway. So you know, early March, Sarah Brush learns that there's this complaint. And there was later, by the way, some dispute about, you know, exactly what this housing director told her. But the impression that she came away with is that the complaint was being taken very seriously by the deans, and that some of the deans wanted to use this as a kind of teachable moment to educate people about racial bias, and that she might be ordered to either take implicit bias training, or she might even be required to participate in a sort of town hall style campus meeting where she would have to discuss her racism. And of course, Sarah Brush is absolutely appalled by all of this, particularly because so much of her work, including at Yale, has to do with sort of civil rights related activism. She had been an assistant in organizing a campus conference on mass incarceration, which is obviously an issue with a big sort of racial component. She also helped organize another conference that was basically to honor the first woman who, because she was Sarah Brush was a was in the philosophy program, the PhD program in philosophy at Yale, and this conference that she was an assistant on was to honor the first woman who was a philosophy, a PhD in philosophy, the first black woman who was a PhD in philosophy at Yale. She's doing a lot of work that has to do with these racial issues, and she really feels that, you know, if she is kind of depicted as a racist, this is really going to kind of destroy her career and her reputation among her colleagues. So, you know, and then she starts this correspondence with the dean where she says, you know, could I at least see this complaint and, you know, and learn what's in it. And the dean basically says, no, this is, you know, prior correspondence from two students, and, you know, I really cannot show you this letter. So she's put in this impossible situation where she knows that this letter accusing her of racism is kind of circulating out there. And by the way, she also had an experience, she says, when she was walking on the campus, this is on March 9th, again, this is like 2 months prior to the dorm incident, where she's walking on the campus and she overhears several students who were walking, I think, the other way, talking about the incident that she was involved in with the call to the police, because they mentioned the 12th floor of the Hall of Graduate Studies, which is where she lives. And apparently they were saying something like, oh, you know, there was this horrible incident where, you know, this person who lives on the 12th floor of the Hall of Graduate Studies, where somebody called the police on a black guy just because he was there in the stairwell. And, you know, this is like some, you know, out of control racist who should be kicked out of school and thrown off campus. And of course, you know, they didn't mention her name,
right,
but she nevertheless felt kind of deeply
She's feeling harassed. Well, yeah, now you go, then we get to late April, where she's saying that she's thinking that somebody is rattling her doorknob, that they are harassing her in the door. So now we get to May. Last day of finals is May 9th. And as you report, shortly after 2 a.m. on May 8th, Sarah Brash emails some of the housing administrators she had been dealing with that, you know, I want to let you know that I've called the police again. And she tells the story about how she'd gone into the common room, late at night, and, you know, because students had been making noise and all, you know, throughout the evening. And she wrote, "There was someone sleeping on the couch with a blanket completely covering them. I turned on the light and said, 'Who are you? You can't sleep in here. You're not supposed to be sleeping in here. Are you a resident?' And as you point out, the rest is history, because the woman is the woman who had been filing the complaint against her, pulls down the blanket and says, 'Hey, aren't you the one who, you know, called the cops on the party?'" So, you know, why did Brash then call the cops, though, at that point?
Right. Well, because she had this ongoing situation before that where she believed, like, in April, she wrote a number of complaints where she said she believed she was being harassed. And this is where, you know, it's really difficult to assess some of those claims, because, you know, she does tend to be sort of paranoid about her personal safety. And in that situation where she knew she had this, accusation of racism that was kind of hanging over her head, and she had heard herself discussed, you know, while walking on the campus. So, you know, it's really difficult for me to factually say what was going on there. I mean, she believed that there were these noisy parties that were being held in the common room, and she believed that, you know, some of the people who were there were people who had been, you know, harassing her before. And again, some of that may have been really overblown on her part, but she definitely did, if you look at her emails, have a very strong sense that she was being harassed and that people were, yeah. So she decides, when she hears Lalatian Wallace say that, she immediately leaps to the conclusion that, well, this is one of the people who have been harassing me. And this is one of the people who really, you know, she really has it in for me. And she is here to harass me. So her response to that was to call the police. And that is, you know, that's the thing that is really going on here.
Like, right. The real question is this, though, this symbol of racism, or is it a much more personal, gritty, complicated story? And of course, what happens is you account, you know, I mean, there's a video of her interaction with the cops, and, you know, it's seen by tens of thousands of folks. Sean King makes it a big issue.
Right.
So if you want to read the whole story, it is up at the Bulwark. It is a very detailed story, and it is an extraordinary story, very, very well documented. Sarah Brash obviously cooperated, and you agree with some of the things she said, but also see that perhaps she had misinterpreted some things. So it is standing up to the moral outrage industry. So Kathy Young, what I want to do with you and Ben is I want to switch gears a little bit and talk about what's going on, because I know that you are very interested in the whole human rights issue, what's going on in Hong Kong. We have the president's bizarre tweets. And Ben, I want to ask you, though, the more difficult question is, okay, so what are we supposed to be doing about all of these cases? And I want to ask those questions right after this word from our sponsor. Today's podcast is brought to you by the Ultimate Sleep Machine. Look at the world's top tech leaders and high-growth startup CEOs, and I bet you wonder, how in the world they have that kind of inexhaustible energy to do what they do? And the answer might surprise you. The latest trend with top tech leaders is sleep optimization. While most Americans aren't getting the sleep they need, tech founders and CEOs are optimizing their sleep to perform at peak levels every day. The first step, the Pod by 8 Sleep, the ultimate sleep machine. The Pod is the first and only high-tech bed designed to help you achieve peak mind and body performance. So are you looking to sleep deeper? The Pod dynamically adjusts the temperature on each side of the bed so you're comfortable all night. Do you want to know your sleep intel? The Pod tracks your biometrics while you sleep with no need for wearable technology. Do you want to sleep better? Enjoy personalized programs and coaching designed by experts guiding you towards true sleep fitness. Because the better you sleep, the better you everything. Try the pod for 100 nights. And if you don't love it, we'll refund your purchase and arrange for a free pickup. Only at 8sleep.com/bulwark. Now, they already sold out their first two batches, so they're going fast. For a limited time, get $150 off your purchases. That's $150 off your purchase when you go to 8sleep.com/bulwark. That's EIGHTsleep.com/bulwark. Okay, we are back with Kathy Young and with Ben Parker. And I strongly recommend that you read Kathy's whole story, the Standing Up to the Moral Outrage Industry, because this is we're at this very difficult time right here. You know, where, you know, anti-racist activism, as Kathy writes, is open our eyes to these real and painful problems. But there is an ugly side to this, including this scarlet R and the moral panic that we sometimes engage in that results in people being nailed for committing acts that perhaps are taken completely out of context. Okay, I mean, you know, and obviously there's a lot of examples of this. You know, the Covington High School kids, things that happened at Oberlin, the Chipotle worker who was fired over the video, all of those things that, lacking in context, you know, are fit into a narrative. Okay, Ben Parker, I want to switch gears. Hong Kong. The president's policy appears to be an absolute mess. You can correct
That's
me if you have a different... Yeah, not a surprise, but I mean, we did have that report of the last 24 hours from Politico that he had spontaneously promised President Xi that he was not going to intervene or oppose whatever he did in Hong Kong, and this stunned his aides. His aides have been pushing for him to do, or at least, you know, again, we're getting the spin out of the White House. We want, you know, a stronger position in favor of these pro-democracy demonstrators. They haven't been getting any traction because the president is putting the priority on his trade war rather than human rights issues. This report comes out. Now the president is tweeting out sort of vague, you know, pro-protester things. So what should the president be saying at this point?
So the first thing you should do is, I think I wrote this back in March when the protests first started, he should go and he should read the National Security Strategy, the document that lays out what our goals are in terms of promoting American interests that his own administration produced in 2017, which is that China, you know, is a competitor to the U.S.-led global system, and we should stand up to it. We should point out that their vision of what the world should be like is not as good as ours. And so he should read that, and he should say, we are on the side of the protesters. And, you know, I think in JVL's newsletter yesterday, he laid out that there's not much we can do. You know, we're not going to go start bombing Shenzhen. We're not going to put Marines in Hong Kong, but certainly we can go out and we can say, we stand on the side of the protesters. They are fighting for freedom and their rights and self-government, just as we did 240 odd years ago. And we stand with them in their fight to join the other 3 billion people in the world who live under free governments, and they have our full moral support. And, oh, and by the way, when they are standing in the streets of Hong Kong waving American flags and singing our anthem, it's not because they're CIA stooges. It's not because we give them help. It's because they want to join those 3 billion free people and not be crushed under the Chinese boot.
And people all over the world are watching this, right? I mean,
yeah, exactly.
It's also, you know, we may not be able to stay China's hand, but at least they stake out that moral position. I mean, you've written about this extensively, Kathy. You know, there's the authoritarianism seems to be on the march, and you're a native of the Soviet Union, and there are people in Russia who are also pushing back against authoritarianism.
Yeah, and this is sort of really fascinating to me that right now there is suddenly this upsurge of protest in Russia and China simultaneously, and of course in both countries the leadership is going to try to paint this as the doing of the Americans. And it is a kind of difficult situation because on the one hand, and people have often pointed this out, I think the same thing happened with the Iran protests in 2009, when a lot of people criticized President Obama for, you know, not supporting the protesters. There is a kind of real conundrum where if we are seen as sort of too vocally on the side of the protesters, a lot of people say, well, that's just going to make the protesters look like American puppets. The problem, though, is that I'm not sure that that's a valid argument because they're going to get painted as American puppets anyway. You know, I mean, that is really what happens. I think all of these authoritarian regimes, for them, the United States is this sort of perpetual scapegoat where any pro-freedom activity that happens in the country is going to be seen as, American subversion. And I think there is a way to speak up for that cause and, for those protesters without necessarily, feeding into the narrative that they're American puppets.
Right. Well, you would hope you would give some encouragement, right, to people.
Yeah. And I think I think one of the ways you can do that is by connecting what's going on in Hong Kong to places where very clearly the United States has no involvement. So connect the protests in Hong Kong, the president could, to the oppression of the Tibetans that's been going on for half a century or more, to the oppression of the Uyghurs that's going on right now. No one says that the Uyghurs are all CIA operatives and spies and all that. That's ridiculous. Not even the Chinese say that.
Right.
But you can say this is all part of one larger oppression. It's just like what happened, connected to Tiananmen Square. That makes it harder to just say, well, this is a CIA plot if it's a pattern that's happening all around China.
You know that Donald Trump is not going to do that because Donald Trump is, first of all, his view of foreign policy is transactional rather than aspirational. I don't think that he is deeply offended by human rights abuses. He does seem to have a fascination and affinity for authoritarians. So Ben, I was talking about this with Ben Wittes yesterday, and he brought up the Uyghurs, what's going on, and the complete lack of international condemnation. And I sort of get why the Trump administration might not, not want to object. But how do you explain the rest of the world turning its back on this issue? It just doesn't seem to be registering anywhere. Or am I wrong about that?
I don't think you're that wrong. I think generally it's not registering because the only country that has the kind of leadership, both institutional and diplomatic and economic and all other kinds, to actually raise us think about this is the United States. That's what defines the United States' role in the world, is that if there's a big country like China, a big important country that does something terrible, we can muster the rest of the world to say, actually, that's not good. We're not going to abide by that. We did this after the Russians annexed Crimea, after they invaded Ukraine and shot down a Ukrainian airliner. We've done this in the past. The Russians are still under those sanctions. If we wanted to do it about the Uyghurs, we could. It actually wouldn't be terribly, terribly hard. It would be economically more difficult, but politically probably not. We just don't have the leadership that wants to do it.
One thing that occurred to me, you would think that with the Trump administration so kind of vocally supportive of Israel and so so critical of the sort of the anti-Israel backlash around the world, you would think that they would kind of jump at this opportunity to say, here's a case where Muslims are actually being, herded into concentration camps, essentially, and being subjected to all these really horrible abuses where they're being put through re-education to essentially force them to abandon their religion. There are reports of women being forcibly sterilized. And yet, I would think that, you would really say this, as a supporter of Israel, especially. And yet, the same people who are filled with outrage at the human rights abuses that are said to be happening toward the Palestinians, yet there is not a peep out of them about these really, really horrible things that are being done to to hundreds of thousands of Muslims. And yet there is this complete silence. And I think the answer is that, again, this president is really just, his instinct really is to be friendly to authoritarians. And remember, he made the statement way back when about Tiananmen Square, essentially saying that, it was kind of terrible, but at the same time, it was really this, strong move to...
Glad you reminded me of that, because he's already spoken of that he actually likes the exercise of strength and that he actually admires this. Okay, now, speaking of Israel, because we're running out of time here, and this just just this story just broke. I think there had been some suggestions was going to happen here. Israel now has formally, Netanyahu, the prime minister, has formally reversed himself, decided to bar the two congresswomen who wanted to go to Israel, Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib. He is barring them from visiting Israel during a trip scheduled to start this weekend. This comes after a rather extraordinary intervention by President Trump, who went on Twitter urging a foreign country to deny entry to elected American officials. I mean, this is one of those, the norms being broken here are so extensive, it kind of makes your head hurt. But I Ben know. Parker, yeah. give me your take on all of this. The President of the United States telling Benjamin Netanyahu to bar these two Democratic congresswomen, and then Netanyahu going, yeah, I will do your bidding.
Yeah, so whoever the political advisors are who told, in the Knesset, who told Netanyahu this was a good idea, they should be sacked. They should be fired immediately. Because Israel's whole goal with its relations with the United States is to be a consensus ally on both sides of the aisle. And that's been very hard for them of recent years, but they should really try. And if you're going to hitch your wagon to one train right now, politically in the United States, why are you choosing the Republican Party, right? Look at any poll. Look at the resignations from Congress. Who right now is expecting the Republican Party to be to be ascendant? Who is telling Netanyahu, oh yeah, they're Republicans, those are the ones who are going to be in power in 4 years. You really want those guys on your side. Who is telling him this?
Okay, but Kathy, I mean, these two congresswomen have been very, very critical of Israel. They have been supportive of the BDS movement. So, is there a legitimate reason to bar them from visiting Israel?
Right. Well, you know, I think I can see the reasoning here because, you know, yes, they have been supportive of the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement. This is not a move that is directed at the Democratic Party as a whole, you know, arguably. And of course, these two congresswomen themselves are sort of the focal point of a lot of dissension within the Democratic Party, in which, you know, a lot of which, in fact, has to do with their position in Israel. So I don't know if it's kind of a declaration of war to the Democratic Party, I would say. On the other hand, I think Israel certainly has allowed various, you know, critics of Israel to visit, given, again, that these are elected officials in the United States. I would say Israel would really show a stronger hand if they did allow them to visit, and I can see like a million ways in which this could be used as a really positive publicity for Israel, where they, you know, for them to say, are open to, the political differences, but also
Sheldon Adelson should send them on a birthright trip.
To do this at the urging of Donald Trump, especially, I think that just looks really bad. I mean, that's the part of it that really looks the worst to me. I mean, if they just made this move on their own, I think that'd be different.
Well, let's pull back a little bit here. The president is, how long has it taken him to get back to, send her back where she came from, his attack on the squad? Because, I mean, sort of remember, our news cycle goes so quickly that, it was a couple of weeks ago, he was hammering them and clearly relishing making the members of the squad, these minority women, making them the face of the Democratic Party. And there were a lot of people, including me, who thought that there was sort of a reptilian cunning there, that he was trying to define his enemies, define the socialist radical American party that, hates America and look who they are, that this was, part of his what he thought of as an effective strategy, and maybe some other Republicans did as well. And then, of course, things went, terribly badly with the mass shooting and the accusations that he perhaps had incited violence. There was a lot of blowback to the chance of send her back. But it's taken how long for him to sort of snap back to go, I'm back to this. I'm back to a fight I want to have with these two women. I mean, it's for anyone who thought that, yes, maybe what happened in El Paso or Dayton, might cause, people to say to him, hey, maybe you should dial it down. Maybe we ought to move on to something else. Here he is basically back to where we were, as if nothing had happened in the last 2 or 3 weeks.
Well, he's clearly appealing to his base. I think sure. that the only way that I can interpret this is that this is really red meat for the base because
yeah, but his base isn't big enough anymore. I mean, this is the problem. You look at this Fox News poll, and I mean, it's become now a cliche that he's, you know, the Republicans are getting annihilated in the suburbs in a lot of these swing states. So, you know, it seemed to me that he's sort of almost he's still stuck on red meat to the base. When I think the politics right now is, you know, aren't you simply underlying the fact that you are setting Americans against one another? You are tearing the country apart, and you are willing to play these questionable racist cards, Ben. I mean,
right. And I think, you know, you can be extremely critical of these two congresswomen without, you know, kind of going this extra step. I mean, you could say that, you know, they should let them visit Israel and see firsthand how, you know, Israel is open to its critics and how, you know, Israel. I mean, there are just so many ways you can sort of spin. You can use this as a very positive thing, you know, for the alliance between Israel and the United States. Yeah.
Well, that's why I agree with you, Ben. This, you know, is make short term logic to Benjamin Netanyahu, who is incapable of saying no to Donald Trump, obviously. But long term, this is, I think, a tremendous it's a lost positive opportunity for Israel. And long term, I think it's going to be a problem.
Yeah, it's not a smart move. As you were saying, you know, it's not looking very good for the Republicans. And, you know, Israel is in many ways still dependent on the alliance with the United States for its security in a lot of different ways. We share intelligence, we share military technology, all sorts of things. And that's why they need a bipartisan consensus that they're a good ally, that they're a strong ally, that we should keep them as an ally in the United States across party lines. It's good for us, too, to acknowledge that, you know, a free democracy in the Middle East is in our interest. I actually sort of disagree with you, Kathy. I think this is going to be treated as a slap in the face of the entire Democratic Party because he did it at Donald Trump's insistence. And, you know, in just a few years, that may turn around and be a very serious strategic mistake for the Israelis.
Yeah. I mean, I think you're probably right. Because given, again, you know, not even necessarily the act of, you know, of barring them from Israel per se, but as you say, the fact that it was done at the urging of Donald Trump, I think.
I think that's hard to get away with. Yeah. But of course, he's going to look at this by, look, I've once again put them back in the headlines. I have baited Democrats into rallying around them, yada, yada, yada. But I do think that the base only strategy is looking less and less, I would say, savvy. I mean, I am one of those who believe that the election will be decided in places like Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan, Wisconsin, and that will be decided by largely white working class rural voters. But I don't think that I don't think that this is the ticket to get to 270 electoral votes next year, as cynical as that may sound. Ben Parker, yes, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Sorry, we should also, we'd be remiss if we didn't point out the irony that Donald Trump just a few weeks ago tweeted, you know, she should go back where she came from. And then when she actually tries to leave the country, he says, no, don't let her in.
Yeah, I thought of that as well. Yeah.
All right. Ben Parker, Kathy Young, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks, Charlie.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast, which was brought to you today by 8 Sleep. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow and we'll do this all over again.